Win your own copy of a signed fantasy novel. I'll tell you how in 30 seconds. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Here on the show, we dive into world building, storytelling, and publishing, and with usually a bit of a focus on sci-fi and fantasy, but I go far afield kind of frequently. Today's interview is with author Justin Germain, who is a professor of Greek and Latin, and he writes his Sigma series, search for book one, Thumos Rising, if you want to have the best chance of finding it, because Sigma is the Greek character, Sigma. Thumos Rising, which is totally not He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, under the pen name Demetrios Lopez. And we'll get back to that soon. Pardon me while I check my notes. But first, the giveaway, right? I told you So here's how. You answer the question of the week, you guess a number, and you're entered in the drawing. And now if you want to go for the two-book power-up, then you guess a letter of the alphabet. And now last week's winner, drum roll please, I'm going to show you what I wrote down while I was recording last week. So the number was 680, and the letter was the letter I. And the winner was Werecat. And you can see the answers for the question of the week in the Discord server. And you can see there. Anyway, yeah. So congratulations to Werecat. And I will be reaching out to you individually to see how you would like me to sign that book and where to ship it to. Now, Werecat had the closest number in her guess out of 1 to 1,000, right? And she guessed 663, I think. 673 was what it was. It was very close. 673. Just really good luck with that guess. So let me tell you the rest of the details of how to win your fantasy book, your copy of a fantasy book. It's pretty easy. You go into my Discord server, and there'll be a link in the show notes or the video description, and you answer the question of the week, which I'll tell you here in a couple of minutes. I'll also post the question of the week in the question of the week channel in my Discord server, so there's not going to be any confusion. You answer this question, it's going to be posted as soon as I finish recording this video, and right now it is Wednesday night, so you're going to see a post from me. This is the question of the week on late in the day of January 8th. That's the question for this week. And so you guess a number between 1 and 1,000. And let me generate that number right now. I'm going to ask Google. Google has a random number generator. Where's my pen? There it is. I'm going to write it on the same page as last week's guess, or last week's random number. So, and next week I'll show you. Well, not next week. I'm going to introduce a one-week delay, so I'm not here recording late at night after I give everybody plenty of time to answer the question of the week. You'll have a full week to answer, and then there will be another week before I announce the questions in the podcast, or the winner in the podcast. So, Google, please give me a number between 1 and 1,000. And that number is right there. And Google, give me a... This actually isn't Google's. There is a randomwordgenerator.com. I'm going to ask it to give me one random letter. That is that. So, here's how it works. You guess a number between 1 and 1,000. The closest guess to 1,000 wins a book. Right there. That's it. You won. But you have to answer the question of the week. So you answer the question of the week. You guess a number between 1 and 1,000. Closest one to that number that I just wrote down wins the book. And if you want to go for a two-book power-up and make it so you win... I'm showing fingers. It's weird. So you can win two books instead of just one. Guess a letter of the alphabet. And if you guess that letter that I just wrote down or the letter right before or after it, then you win two books, not one. So, yeah. Werecat, you can see in my Discord server, she won the question of the week and or the drawing or contest, I guess. Her guess was closest to the number, but the letter was I, and the letter that she guessed was G. So she almost had a two-book pack instead of one, but she was one letter off from that. If she'd put H instead of G, then well, H is only one letter away from I, and she would have gotten two books. So better luck next time. And where am I? What else do I need to cover here? So you answer the question. You guess a number, you get a free signed book. You guess a letter, and maybe you get two free signed books instead of one. Now, one more thing. You're not just going for this book, Nightshade Unicorn Book 1, which is called Forerunner. I'm changing it a little bit after this first week. I'm working with other authors, so that I will have more books to offer in the giveaway. And I'm not just giving away this copy that I'll sign and you're going to be able to choose. So for this week, you can at least choose between my two titles from the first two books in the Nightshade Unicorn series, which are called Forerunner and Guardian. And you may also be able to choose another author's book starting with this week. It's in the middle of that happening. And I'm going to be working to add other authors to the... Yeah, if you win the free book, you're going to be able to choose. And I want to give you more options. Right now, at this moment, it's two options. By the time... this week's contest is closed, it'll probably be three options, and I'll work on adding from there. Now, last week's question of the week was, I have planned an interview with fantasy authors Blake and Raven Penn, who write the Skystone Chronicles. Whether you know anything about them or not, what would you like to hear me ask them during our conversation? And here are some answers that I received in the Discord server. And so these answers are questions, right? So I asked, what questions do you want to hear? And these people provided these questions. They said, what is the hardest part of going from an idea of a story to write to a fully written and published book? And the asker also opened it up for me to answer that question. So I might get to that later. Also, another question somebody posed was, what made them decide to be writers, and what's their inspiration? What is their favorite guilty pleasure? What's the ideal length for a series of books? So I think these are great questions, and I'll shoot them over to them ahead of time. I don't usually have like set questions for my interviews. I do it a little more freeform. But yeah, I'll send these over to them ahead of time, and I don't think they're hard questions, but that first one is really interesting. So yeah, really interesting questions. I look forward to that interview coming up with Blake and Raven Penn. And I anticipate publishing that episode 2 weeks from now. You'll be hearing this on January 9th. So I anticipate publishing that conversation on January 23rd, although things can shift between now and then. It's possible. Now, next week, this could also shift because I haven't recorded this interview yet, but you can expect to hear me talk with author James Figueroa, whom I have known for a decade. We met as Marine musicians when we were working as part of Marine Band San Diego. I'm a clarinetist. You can see my clarinet on... I'm looking at a mirror image. My clarinet on the wall behind me, also an iwi, but anyway. And James Figueroa is a trumpet player. And nowadays, he is rocking a music teaching gig. And I recently learned that he has written and published his own fantasy novel. So I invited him on the podcast for a chat. And we're going to be recording that the same day this episode publishes. So I look forward to that. That'll be interesting. And now in my own author news, what do I have going on right now is I'm looking at the home stretch of Kickstarter fulfillment. I told myself I wasn't doing this, but I did. Like many other first-time Kickstarters, I bit off a little bit more than I could chew, and it took me a lot longer to fulfill than I expected. But now I'm in the home stretch. The first rewards, the big main thing was the book, right? The book itself, actually, the Kickstarter edition of the book, which has a couple of, I think it's five short stories that I threw in the back that the main edition doesn't have. But that went out relatively quickly. It was a bit behind what I thought it was going to be when I launched the campaign, but relatively quickly. Whereas some of these other things, these bookmarks, took me a long time to get these done. And now page overlays took me another while to get around to finishing those. But I'm almost done. I have the designs hypothetically finished. I promised five page overlays and, you know, a pack of five page overlays, where it's a see-through page and you can put it on the book and see the words of the scene through the image that you're, that is depicted. Anyway, so I promised five page overlays. As of tonight, I have five designs. I thought I was going to have to order them and then wait for them to come in the mail, but I was able to print the first couple of them on vellum here at home. It was a little bit of a challenge because the printer can see through the vellum, and so it thinks there is no page, and so it doesn't want to print. I had to trick it. I can print here at home. I have not yet tried to print the last two designs. So it's possible that when I see how they turn out, I might have to go back and adjust something here and there. But I have five complete designs. And tomorrow I'll be printing those. And unless something big happens, I think not later than Friday, those will be in the mail. And then there will be one more thing remaining for this Kickstarter campaign before I can tie it up and call it done. And that is a song. Like I said, I'm a musician, or I didn't exactly say that in this episode, but I said I worked in Marine Band San Diego as a clarinetist. Yeah. So, there's a poem. There is a song in the book Forerunner. The lyrics of the song are there, and I composed a simple tune to go along with it before I published the book. But I need to flesh it out and record it. And that I hope I'll be able to finish this month. Now, something did come up, which might delay a little bit more, not much. So, announcement here. Come see me in person next weekend. If you're in Virginia or North Carolina, or if you want to drive far enough, I'm going to be in Virginia Beach at MarsCon. Next weekend, the weekend of January 17th. And I'm going to check the calendar again because I always keep mixing up these dates. I thought I was going to miss my daughter's spelling bee, but because I thought it was going to be on Saturday. But no, it's Wednesday, and I will be in town at home for that. So yeah, the weekend of January 17th, come see me at MarsCon, and yeah, get your book signed, get some cool bookmarks. I actually have some 3D prints I need to show on the podcast. I'll do that one of these days. But I have some 3D prints, like unicorn horns that I printed, and unicorn little decorative unicorn heads. But it sounds morbid to say it like that, but it's not. Like a bust of a human, you know, it's from here up. So I have that in unicorn heads. For Ranamon and for the Nightshade Unicorn. And I'll be selling those at the con. Anyway, so, yep, MarsCon in Virginia Beach next weekend. And right now I'll tell you about one con in February. I will be at StoryCon February 21st and 22nd. And I will also be at a con somewhere in the country the weekend before that. And I'll be at another one the weekend after that. And these things are booked. It's set. It's going to happen. But I'm not going to tell you that until a little bit closer to the date. I'm not going to let it be like, tomorrow I'm going to be there. No. I'll give you, I guess, like I am right now, I'm giving you a week's notice. At least I'll give you at least a week's notice of where I'm going to be those two weekends. Or if you really, really want to know, go back me on Ko-fi and you'll automatically get access to a hidden channel in my Discord, and the information is already posted there. Now, one more thing before we go into this week's interview with author Demetrios Lopez is the new question of the week. So this week's question of the week, and I think in the future I'll announce it at the end of the episode. It just feels like it would make more sense. But again, that'll come into play with the extra 1 week delay to announce the winners. And anyway, so this week's question of the week is related to my interview with Demetrios Lopez, because he didn't pursue his author dreams for a long time because of what he understood or misunderstood possibly about fan fiction, how that works, and how, you know, you'll hear in the interview, but he was kind of held back from his author dream for a long time because of something that he wasn't really aware of. When he became aware of what he could do, then he jumped in and did it. So the question is, if you wanted to write a book, what do you think might be holding you back? Or if that's too personal, you know, to tell about your own story, or your own journey. Or if you don't care to write a book, then what are some things you see that might hold back people? I really phrased that awkwardly. What are some things that you see that could hold back somebody else? To repeat myself, because I stumbled over my words and, so what is holding you back, or what would hold you back if you wanted to write a book, or what might hold you back, or what do you think might hold people back? And this podcast isn't really geared towards authors necessarily. I just think it's an interesting question. I know that, there are a lot of author podcasts out there, like aimed to the audience of authors. And I cast a wider net with mine. I hope to be interesting to both authors and readers who don't necessarily have any... I'm not assuming that you're trying to be an author. But I think it might still be an interesting question anyway. Anyway, so yeah, that's enough for me. Feel free to freeform the question. Go into my Discord server to answer that question. Don't worry about trying to remember what it was. It'll be posted in there. Guess a number between 1 and 1,000. Guess a letter of the alphabet. Win a free book. And I'll turn the time over to the interview. All right, Justin, welcome to the show today. And for all our listeners out there, this is you write under a pen name.
That's right.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and then how you came into writing and what your background is generally?
Yeah. So again, I am Justin Germain. That's what's on my birth certificate. However, I write under the name Demetrios Lopez. A bit of a funny story about that. When I initially published the book, I had sort of this idea of sort of anonymity. Kind of there's this J.K. Rowling quote where like she writes the first Potter book. It's like plotted in secrecy, like plotted in darkness, right? Almost like it's a secret that no one else knows. But of course, when you're trying to sell books, that's all well and good when you're trying to write the book. But when you actually want to sell the book, there's publicity. And again, I've gotten a lot of support from my publisher, but you know, even that only goes so far. So if you want the books to sell, you got to do a lot of marketing on your own. You got to show up to book signings and book events. You got to do podcasts, just like this one. And you have to get on social media. And so lo and behold, my face is all over TikTok and Instagram. I never thought that would be the case. I've been off social media for almost 10 years. And like, here I am trying to figure out how to like, what's the difference between a reel and a story and, you know, all that.
I still don't.
Yeah, right. But all that to say, I figured that it's pretty kind of silly because my face is all over it, right? And anyone's going to be able to figure out who I am fairly quickly.
Yeah.
But yes, pen name is Demetrios Lopez. I am a quarter Greek. I go to a Greek Orthodox church. I teach ancient Greek for a living. So a heavy connection with the Greek culture, hence Demetrios. And my dad's last name was actually Lopez. So I just thought it was kind of a, you know, common enough to be like, oh, that's a real name, but kind of sexy enough to be a little mysterious. And I thought that would fly. And so that's the name. Now, you asked about just sort of my background, how I got into writing.
Yeah.
So background, as I already mentioned, I'm a teacher by trade. I teach ancient Greek and Latin. And when I say that, I mean, I teach students how to read ancient Greek and Latin texts primarily. Now, there is a little bit of writing. We don't do much speaking because unless you want to work for the Pope, no one really speaks Latin anymore. There are these like super pretentious like Latin parties that academics sometimes will have. And what I found is that the more you tend to drink, the better their Latin gets and the better you understand it. But that's neither here nor there. But generally speaking, people aren't speaking ancient Greek and Latin anymore, right? So you're teaching students how to read the language so they can go on and read the text in the original language. And of course, there's always something lost in the translation. So that's sort of the big picture goal. A little bit on a, I don't even know if I'd say smaller scale, but that's kind of the A story, right? Again, we're writers. Uh-huh. We talk about the A story versus the B story. The B story there is those languages, the way they work. It really does rewire the brain to think about language in a very systematic way that I think a lot of, certainly English speakers, native English speakers don't, right? So, but we also get some culture as well. I teach a literature and film class where we go all the way from like ancient Greek myth through the fall of Rome in the West and the rise of Christianity. And then as far as my, how that sort of led me into writing. So I grew up, I was born in 81. So I'm very much a child of the 80s. Loved He-Man and the Masters of the Universe growing up. And sometime, I guess I was in my, I don't know, maybe mid-20s, I went to a Barnes & Noble and I wanted to pick up some He-Man fiction, right? Some novelization of these characters treated in a more adult way, but, you know, that I loved as a kid. And of course, there's no shortage of this. You know, go to any bookstore, you'll find Star Wars spinoffs, right? Mm-hmm. Star Trek, X-Men, Spider-Man, Super. I mean, a lot of these, you know, bigger IPs, they have this, right? And I got to be honest with you, Don, I was just really sort of lowercase O offended that I didn't find any He-Man. And so I immediately went home and I started writing the He-Man novel that I would have wanted to have read. It was based off a plot line that I had sort of worked out years before as a kid when I was playing with my He-Man toys way back in like 84 and 85.
Did that actually turn into what you published as the Sigma?
Okay. It did. So again, if you read the book, the world that it's set in is the world of Nineveh. And I get that name from the ancient Arcadian city of Nineveh. And some people might be familiar with that. They know their Hebrew Old Testament. But it is a world very similar to Eternia, where He-Man and his adventures happen, right? So you have dragons and spaceships. You have magic and you have advanced technology.
I actually don't know much about He-Man. So I'm some 3 years younger than you are, but somehow I just missed it, maybe. Right. But I remember thinking that He-Man was cool when I was a little kid. But I can't remember a single plot line from any episode.
Well, again, and I don't know how far down this rabbit hole you want to go, but it was revolutionary in a couple ways, and it sort of rose and fell a bit like a meteor, right? I mean, they were almost kind of like, I talk about He-Man, he's kind of like the Doors of like 80s kids cartoons, in that very influential, but also somewhat short-lived. Right. Just doesn't, you know, the Doors don't have the range that, say, the Beatles do or the Rolling Stones. Right. So all that to say, when the show first aired, the toys came first from Mattel. And they had these really cool toys. The story goes is that they had a contract to do toys for Arnold Schwarzenegger's Conan the Barbarian film that had came out like a year before. Right. Or it was about to come out. I'm not entirely sure of the timeline. But they had a contract, but that fell through because of, you know, businessmen and women doing businessy things.
Yeah.
And so they said, well, we can't do Conan, but they already had this prototype. Let's do see if we can do something similar. And so they come up with He-Man, who is basically Conan with blonde hair set in a, you know, the difference being Conan's like hardcore classic Robert E. Howard fantasy. There's no spaceships. There's no laser guns. But in He-Man, we're going to do spaceships and laser guns, right? So they sort of combine this as a little bit of Strange Worlds element to it as well. And then they developed the show to promote the toys. And then when the show came on, my understanding, it was the first children's show that was slotted into daily airings during the week. So, you know, a lot of shows up to that point, like you might watch Saturday morning cartoons. There might be a new Super Friends every Saturday morning or something like that. But like for He-Man, it was like Monday through Friday, you got a new show. And the toy sold like hotcakes. I mean, I just sort of remember it. Like everybody, you know, it was like Transformers was big, G.I. Joe was big, Thundercats, but like He-Man, at least in my group, seemed to be like at the top. It got a live action. It got an animated film, and then it got a major live action motion picture in 86. Now, by the time you get to 86, the buzz had kind of died. The movie wasn't good. So in some ways, it almost peaked before its time. And sometimes I wonder in an alternate universe where it had gone maybe the Transformers route, right? Where it was big enough to absolutely land a mark, but you know, you didn't get that first big movie deal until later when you had better effects. Better CGI, things might have gone differently.
So how does that get into Sigma? Tell us a little bit about your book series. And in our messaging back and forth, you sent it with the Sigma character, the Greek character. Yeah. You didn't write out S-I-G-M-A. Yeah. So listeners need to search for that Sigma character, or can they find it if they put SIGMA1 or...
So here's what I tell people to search for. Search Thumos Rising. Just put Thumos Rising in Amazon or Google. It's going to pop right up. And again, it's spelled just like it sounds. Thumos, just, you know, grade school, spell it out. Rising.
Yeah.
I have found that, again, having the Greek character as like the main title, in one way, people have told me, well, it's very memorable, right? It sticks in your head. You know, you go into a bookstore, there's so many, you know, a storm of swords and spears, or, you know, there's some of these titles are very formulaic. So it does stand out. Again, of course, the problem is most people don't have a Greek keyboard on their computer too, or their smartphone. Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword, but no, I would say, Google Thumos Rising and it'll pop right up. Also if you put in Demetrios Lopez, my website is going to come right up. But, I guess going back to your, question, so how it plays in, is that as I kept working on the He-Man fanfic, you know, you're working on, you're putting more blood, sweat, and tears into it. You have a couple of people read it. You got your first draft, you edit it, you have your second draft. I realized that I just really loved reading and rereading and, you know, reading for the 17th time this story. I just thought it was a really good yarn to spin. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that, you know, I'd like to try to see what I could do with it. Of course, if you go with like a known IP, you have copyright issues, and I'm just a little guy. I wouldn't even know how to start with that. So I said, I'm going to break it off. We're going to do our own thing. A little bit 50 Shades of Grey to Twilight-ish. If you know, listeners know that story, how supposedly 50 Shades started out as Twilight fanfic, but they, you know, decided to do their
own thing. I think I heard that once.
Yeah. I should say it's a very different book than 50 Shades of Grey. If we can be even 10% that successful, I will be singing from the rafters. But so that's how it developed into what it is, and just breaking away from the, because He-Man, for all that it was a kid's cartoon, right? There were some kind of sillier elements to it, and allowing me to break away and really make my own world allowed it to take wings and sort of become its own thing. And it also allowed me... go ahead.
So your Sigma series is totally not He-Man.
It's totally not He-Man. Again, if people know He-Man well, then they can read it and they can be like, oh, I this character is that. But I think you would have to know it well. And I've ran the tests. So a lot of people that just know He-Man on a surface level, like, oh, I tell them after the fact, they're like, oh, I had no idea. As far as the Sigma specifically, it's got a bit of a double meaning, right? So again, outside of He-Man and some literary influences that I'm sure we'll get into, the classics, the Greek and Roman world have heavily influenced my writing. In some ways, the whole series is very much going to be an analogy for ancient Roman Stoicism. And in the Stoic philosophy, this Greek word sophia, which means wisdom, is kind of the great thing that shall set you free, right? I guess to put another way, if you think of sort of like Christianity, but sort of take out the Jesus and put in just wisdom in this very, you know, amorphous sense, that is sort of the thing that is going to save humanity. And my main character, Zeno, is very much a Stoic character. And as a matter of fact, I get the name from Zeno of Citium, who was the ancient Greek who founded Stoicism way back in the fourth century. Also, again, sort of the double meaning here, Zeno is very much a Superman character. And for all the sci-fi and fantasy elements, and it took me a while, Don, to really, I guess, sort of figure out the best way to kind of pitch the book. But ultimately what this is it's a Superman story. Zeno is a Superman. He's a Paul Atreides. He is someone, one of these sort of a superhero.
Kind of set apart.
Right. The superhero that has these incredible powers. Of course, he doesn't wish for them. And he is given them, and he's put in a world that is a very gray, in chaos, in turmoil, a lot of evil happening in that world. And he has to figure out the best way to use these powers. So, of course, the Greek letter Sigma is the English equivalent to the S. And so just like Superman has his S, Zeno has his Sigma. And a bit of a copy, but a copy in Greek. So I figured it would be good. And with the Stoicism, it plays out pretty well.
Cool. So can you tell us more about how the ancient Greek or Latin, how they influence your writing? Yeah, maybe we'll go down a rabbit hole. I think that's terribly interesting.
Yeah.
So I speak a second language myself. I learned Spanish as an adult.
Okay.
But, you know, I took 3 years in high school, and I couldn't speak Spanish after those 3 years in high school.
Right.
But it kind of started getting me, like you said, that learning ancient Greek, even if you never use it as such, changes the way you think. And so, like, starting with high school Spanish, I got into thinking about what does that word mean? Where does it come from? And why do we use it the way we do? Sure. And thinking about how language works. Now, you don't have to go down the path of like how language works, but how do you see those elements from antiquity, whether it's language or other aspects of culture, play into how you approach your writing and how events play out in your books?
Right. Again, really just sort of great and multi-layered question there. So I guess the first thing that comes to mind, and I don't know who said it originally, but there's this quote. I read it it was being quoted in an Earl Shore's book, The Life and Times of Mexico, but just talking about language and language acquisition. And the quote was, those who only know one language don't fully know that one. And sort of the idea being that your mind is really boxed in by the way you think, which is boxed in by language, right? All that to say, if a language just doesn't have a word for a certain thing, it becomes incredibly difficult to explain the thing in that language. And of course, being a Spanish speaker, you know, like there's a big difference between me encanta and me quiero or yo quiero and yo amo, right? I mean, there are these layers. In Greek, it's the same thing. In Greek, there's not just one verb for love. There are four. And depending on, and there's subgroups even to that. And so depending on exactly what kind of love you're talking about, very much alters the verb you're going to use. And for instance, you wouldn't use the verb agapo, which is sort of the godly love. You see it all the time, you know, in things like the New Testament, right? To talk about God's love. But you wouldn't use that to talk about your child or your spouse or even your country. You'd use a different kind of verb, right? Uh-huh. So specifically how that plays, specifically how that plays into the book. So Zeno specifically is a character that is wrapped up in this Greek concept of Andrea. Now, if you were to look that up in a Greek dictionary, an ancient Greek dictionary, it would say bravery. And look, that's not bad. Okay. I mean, we have a word bravery in English. But again, that's not really quite what the Greeks meant by it, right? Because again, bravery is something that anybody could have. We would even say an animal, right? I mean, if you have a cat that's fighting off a dog, a really large dog or something like that, you'd say, oh, that cat is very brave. You wouldn't use Andrea in that way in ancient Greek. It's really, the best sort of explanation I've heard of it is from a scholar, Michelle Paglia, that I want to say is out of University of Pennsylvania, heroic masculinity. That's really what it is. And so it is this sense of this sort of very kind of a traditional masculine archetype, but one in which he is, you know, hyperpowered, superpowered. And so all of a sudden, in Zeno's case, he's really got to figure out very quickly the right ways to use these powers. Again, if I might use my Superman analogy, right? You know, you might be driving down the road. An average guy might drive down the road and get cut off. Uh-huh. And looking, that's not fun. I mean, you almost avoided a wreck. You might lose your temper. Superman can't do that. If he loses his temper, it could possibly destroy the whole city, right? And so putting that in Zeno's context, because he's in a world that's at war, and you do have this very dark antagonist that he's competing against. And you have lots of people that are supporting that antagonist, some of which involuntarily, some of which voluntarily, but they don't have all the information. And so he's got to decide ultimately, again, who lives, who dies, how to reestablish society, how to reestablish the laws, and how to make all these things function in a way that is as close to just as he can possibly get, right? So that would be just sort of one example. On a sort of a lower level, a lot of the words, a lot of Greek and Latin words, I bring in pretty much unaltered for names of deities. Uh-huh. For example, just to give you an idea, the word for grace or charm or beauty in ancient Greek is charis. And again, for us, a flower can be beautiful. I mean, you might even say, oh, that garden has a lot of charm. But in ancient Greek, that is it's a feminine charged word. It's something that men can't have. Uh-huh. And even a very attractive man, right, could never have. And you certainly wouldn't use it of an animal or an inanimate object. It's only something that women have. And there's sort of this two sides of it. There's sort of this elegant beauty that inspires things like loyalty and duty and honor. But then there's also this kind of Jezebel archetype, right? It can also be that thing. It's used very often of Helen, for example, in the Iliad. And sort of the great power and the terror of Helen was that, and again, of course, for listeners that don't know, I mean, she is the woman who her kidnapping starts the Trojan War, right? Which leads to all the suffering for the ancient Greeks and the Trojans. But the reason why Helen was such an infamous figure in Greek myth was because she was a woman that had the power to both trick men into drawing swords when they shouldn't, when they should have peace, but also into sheathing their swords when really what they need to do is fight. Like, that's actually the best thing to do in the scenario for, you know, long term for everybody. And for the Greeks, both would have been equally problematic. Well, so anyway, I take this concept, Charis, and I use that. That is the goddess of love in the series, in the world of Ninevan. But just like in the Greek aspect, there's Charis the matriarch, which is sort of this, maybe a more socially positive, we might say, like version of the goddess. And then there's Charis the maiden, which is this more innocent. But then there's also the, you know, Charis the in the myth, which is like, for example, if a woman seduced a man out of marriage, right, you might say, well, Charis the got a hold of that guy, right, or something like that. When you're saying your vows, though, you might swear your vows to Charis the matriarch. So it plays into the mythology and it plays into the world building of the story.
Okay. Sounds like, really involved. And you made me remember, have you seen Red One?
The new one with I have
Dwayne Johnson.
I hear different things about it.
Yeah, they put a little bit of an interesting twist on Santa Claus.
Okay.
And he's played by, I can't remember the actor's name.
I think it's J.K. Simmons, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's it. I love that guy. That's why I was interested.
So you've got this muscular Santa Claus, right. And he burns like 4.3 million calories every Christmas Eve. And that's why you leave out the milk and cookies for him to help him keep going.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
So you got muscular Santa Claus. But what was interesting was they put in this reference to the origins of Saint Nicholas,
right,
who came from, like, he was in the Greek Orthodox.
Yeah.
Church, I think, and
Saint Nicholas of Smyrna.
And in what is now geographically part of Turkey, but
right,
but he was Greek, and so when he says fly reindeer, he doesn't say fly. He says, I'm trying to pronounce it the way he did, which I went online and learned out that apparently they got their research a little wrong. He says kavalame, and
it's an imperative.
Apparently, he should have said kavalame.
Right, right.
And so it means ride, I guess. And and when people talking about it online, I was like, whoa, yeah, that's I can see how the Latin came from that, because in Spanish, horse is caballo.
Right. Yeah.
But it should be kavalame for, you know, let's ride. And kavalame apparently could mean some alternate versions of writing.
Sure. It's so, open to interpretation.
Yeah. No, but it was, so maybe they got their research a syllable wrong, but it was a really good touch overall.
I don't know. To me, so I guess let me just say a couple things. I'm not really a purist, right? Again, so my story really starts with me taking He-Man and making wide sweeping and substantial changes to it, right? Now, I understand there is a kind of fan and consumer out there that, you know, okay, you've got the source material, you fall in love with the source material, and you're like, okay, any variation, right, is kind of reason to, you know, get out the pitchforks and the torches, right?
Mm-hmm. But language is defined by the people who speak it.
Exactly. Right. I am always open. I think some of it's just like trying to keep an open mind in general, right? Go ahead.
I think a language is defined by people who speak it, but you do have to acknowledge history to some extent and roots, because
The balance
and logic. So people will use language wrong. Or they'll change language, and sometimes things are deemed acceptable just because they're so common.
Right.
Like omitting the Oxford comma.
Right, which is a big deal.
Is technically considered acceptable, but if you include the Oxford comma, there's more clarity. Things make more sense more easily.
Well,
And so like there's like, how does English require the Oxford comma? Well, no, because language is defined by the people who speak it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people call that acceptable to leave it out.
Right.
On the other hand, if you want to communicate clearly, and the Oxford comma isn't the end all be all. Sure. It's one thing example. That is, it's yes, an example.
Right. Yeah, I guess a couple things come to mind, right? Well, I guess maybe two and a half. So one, I mean, the difference between, in any given culture at any given time, right, there's a difference between the language that is spoken by the people and the language that is written down. And of course, I think we take for granted, you know, here in 2025, you know, in certainly in the Western world and well, I don't know, maybe the whole world over, right? Just literacy rates. But you got to remember, before the Industrial Revolution, they weren't great anywhere, right? I mean, even in some place like Rome at the height of its influence, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, people will argue about this, but something like less than 10%, right? And then once they dip during the medieval period, they're not going to come up again until, you know, after the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. So yeah, there's a difference. And, you know, just to give another example, how that kind of plays, like in my classes, right, in my Latin class, when we cover relative pronouns, you know, I'm going through and I'm like, okay, what this would have translated to is whom. I see the man.
And people are like, what?
Yeah.
What's the difference between who and whom?
Right. And they're like, well, wait, you mean who? I'm like, and I try to explain. I was like, look, if you want to write who in your translations, just write it in such a way that you make it clear that you understand the concept. Like, I'm cool with that. Like, I'm really not here to grade your English. I'm here to grade your Latin, right? But mm-hmm. but at the same time, there is a bit of a power in knowing, okay, according to the Queen's English, this is whom, right? But now on the street, we would just, and even in a lot of writing, a lot of informal writing, we just say who. And some of the background of that is whom is what you would refer to as a inflected or declined form of who in English. There was a time when English had what's known as a case system, which is exactly what Latin has. And it's just basically this idea that any noun, pronoun, or adjective will slightly change its form depending on the job it does in the sentence. Who, I know who let the dogs out, who is the subject of that relative clause, as opposed to I see the man whom the dogs love, whom is the direct object in that relative clause, right? And so again, it gets down to clarity. And then, yeah, I guess the second thing I was thinking, and again, I'm not a linguist, but I do follow them and listen to them and read them from time to time. And there's a linguist out of Columbia, John McWhorter, and he was explaining at one point in an interview how you would think that the more, let's just say, maybe industrialized a society gets, the more complex a language gets. But it actually, generally speaking, doesn't work that way. The reason Greek goes through so many changes is because it's been around for so long, but it's also so widespread. I mean, at its height, it was very much the lingua franca before Rome was. As far as, you know, from Eastern Europe all the way down to Afghanistan.
You've got to stay. I love that term. And I love the irony of the term and how it's used.
Right.
The Greek was the lingua franca. Like, it was the French language.
Yeah, I know. There's a little anachronism there, right? But like, the point being...
No, but I get it. So like, any musician looking at musical scores, you'll see Latin or French or Italian, depending on a lot of factors, but largely the time frame. And so for a while, Italian was basically the language of music. And then it got bounced around a little bit between the Germans and the French. But to this day, like, Italian is the primary language that you see stylistic markings in on sheets of music.
Right. Well, yeah, right. And the way that that's going to play out in Paris in like 1652 is going to be different than the way it's going to play out in New Orleans in 1897, right? Uh-huh. I mean, as you said, defined by the people that speak it, these languages are living things, and even something that you tend to think of as a quote unquote dead language like Latin, right? I mean, again, it's still spoken in the Vatican. They are coming out with Neo-Latin words all the time. Like, there is a word in Latin for American football. I don't know what it is. I heard it a couple times. We covered it at a conference, but they're out there. And all this stuff, it changes. And yeah, that's why I think you got to be, I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm in academia, so there is a type of academic that wants to kind of like snub their nose and like, oh, well, this is the proper way. And if you're not doing it this way, but you know, I'm just like, okay, you really need to remove that stick from, you know, the place where it probably shouldn't be, because that's just not the way you can't, even if you wanted to control these languages and try to have some kind of a border on them, you just can't, right? Like they change. I mean, they evolve like any other, well, like a living organism.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a really interesting discussion. And to kind of close things up, and sorry, I'm kind of looking back and forth between this monitor and that post-it note over there. So we discussed previously the, and this is something for listeners, this is a new thing that I'm foraying out into. I don't know. I'm piloting, I guess, testing out. So I invite you to create a character for me to use in my Nightshade Unicorn series. And I will temper it a little bit. I don't guarantee that the character will be super important or not at all. Like maybe we'll only see this character once, but we'll see him or her at least once. Mm-hmm. And you can name the character after yourself or come up with a name, but I reserve the right to modify it to fit the aesthetics of my series. Mm-hmm. And you can just give me a name, or you can describe this character and set a backstory if you like. But again, maybe we'll only see this character once and not hear the backstory except here on the podcast.
Right. We had initially talked about doing Demetrios, but God, with the backstory, I'm very tempted. Okay, you know what? Let's do Alora.
Okay. How do you spell that?
E-L-O-R-A is a very, very special name to me. And this is... I guess my backstory would be, I mean, take what you would with it. It is a little girl who loves the outdoors and loves her cats.
Mm. Okay. All right. Yeah. And I'll have to,
I need to, I haven't read your,
we have one cat.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm in the series, in the book series.
No cats in the series yet.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Is there even a dog? There's some unicorns.
I was about to say, you've got unicorns.
And there are some, there's a woolly rhino, and there's, I don't think I have any dogs or cats yet. I think somebody mentions a dog.
So this is did you ever see the film, I want to say it was Boyhood, came out maybe 10 years ago, Ethan Hawke.
No.
It was kind of novel in that they actually filmed it with like one child actor over a series of like about 10 years. I think it's the longest production, but there's this one scene in the film where Ethan Hawke is the father and he's talking to his son and they're having this conversation and the son says something like, wouldn't it be cool if we had like Balrogs and dragons, because they're talking about Lord of the Rings. And he's like, well, yeah, that would be cool. But like, what if you had to trade dragons for whales? Like, I don't know. Whales are kind of cool too. And like, if you lived in that alternate universe, wouldn't you kind of like, oh, well, dragons are kind of mundane. But a whale, that would be so incredible, right? And so I always, when I talk to different authors and read fantasy books, I always, you know, and I actually sort of addressed this. Like, I've started working on book three, and there's one place where one of the characters, we go interplanetary by the time we get to book three, and one of the characters makes a joke about cats, and the person he's talking to is like, what? Was a cat, right? And he tries to explain, and then he realizes, oh, you don't have these on this planet, and you know, it's kind of anyway. Yeah, I just think it's so interesting sometimes what we have and what we want, and just kind of the human mind, right? Always the fantastical is the thing we don't have, but you know, yeah. And I, listen, I should say I'm not a cat person. My daughter loves them, but. Cats are kind of magnificent and fantastical in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah. And my kids love our cat. I didn't grow up with cats, and now I'm allergic to cats.
Oh, yeah.
Less so than I used to be, because I've been getting allergy shots.
Okay.
It's so annoying. So annoying. But anyway, I still try to keep my distance from the cat because he can make my eyes itch. Mm. But my kids love him. And he loves to snuggle up and all that. But something else on my post-it note. My listeners will already have heard about this before right now, but I want to thank you for the drawing, for the giveaways, because you're volunteering a copy of your book.
Yeah.
And so thank you for that. Of course. And that'll go to somebody, and I'm still working out the details, so I don't know obviously where that'll go yet, but it's appreciated. Now, where can listeners find you online, and where can they find your books?
Okay, so if you want to find my books, you just simply need to type in Thumos, Thumos, again, just like it sounds, spell it out, Rising. You put that into any search engine, Google, Amazon, the book will pop up. We are on Amazon. We are also on Goodreads, so we have a presence on Goodreads mm-hmm. as well. We've got, various reviews out there, the Midwest Book Review, Kirkus. I mean, a lot of the standards ones. I should, take the moment to self-aggrandize just briefly. The book did win the Gold Award from Titan back in June, slightly before the release. So, and the reviews have, cool.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And again, the reviews have mostly been, very positive. There's always some people, you can't win them all, of course, but generally speaking, the feedback and the reception has been pretty good. So, Thumos Rising, just type it into the search engine. My website is demetrioslopez.com, all one word. And again, spelled pretty much just like it sounds. You can pull that up. If you see a very pale face, white hair, purple eyes, you found the right spot.
The purple eyes are really distinctive.
No, that's, again, a big shout out to my cover designer, Ronaldo. He did a great job with that. It was, I just thought the cover was just super well done. Also on social media, you can find me on Demetrios Lopez. I'm on TikTok. At least I am temporarily. I don't know what's happening with the TikTok ban, but at least for the time being, I'm on TikTok, also on Instagram. Uh-huh. May branch out to Twitter or YouTube, just depending. And I should say, with those channels, you get a little bit more of just sort of me as a human. I have currently been sort of talking a lot about the new Superman film coming out because the character is somewhat near and dear to my heart. But some of it's books that I'm reading. I'm currently working on a John C. Hooking, I think that's the author's name. But it was a double edition, Conan the Barbarian, Conan City of the Dead is the title of the book. So, and sometimes it's just book reviews, talk about what I've been reading, what's been influential, and sometimes just how I'm feeling at the moment. But you can find me in all those places. And again, always happy to engage. I'm not always as fast engaging and responding to things as I should be, but I do try to get back to everybody that finds time in their day to leave a comment.
Cool. Yeah, and I'll have those links in the show notes or the video description. I guess that's pretty much it. Now, for anybody listening, I'll remind you because, and I apologize for the drudgery, but for the giveaways, I'm launching it today as we record. It's January 2nd, and the episode that I'm about to upload to YouTube, etc., right after we hang up, because it's already recorded, already edited. You can win a copy of my books through the giveaway that I tell you the details for in today's episode, January 2nd. And it tells you have to go into my Discord server. So what I'm saying is, here's a reminder to the listeners to go into the Discord server to answer the question of the week so you can enter the drawing for this week's giveaway. But thank you, author Justin Germain, writing as Demetrios Lopez. And stay on after we stop the recording. And we'll catch you next time on the Rand Hill Chronicles podcast.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.